Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 146, with guests, Real World Theology contributor Scott Kelly. Joining him and representing the A Clear Lens podcast is Logan Judy. So listen up, because we've got a really factual show for you. On this episode, we talk the case for Christ and the evidence for faith. I'm really glad that both of you decided that you still wanted to talk about this movie months and months after we had originally agreed to talk about this movie. I am embarrassed. I mean, it's what I get for thinking that I was going to be able to see this in a possibly not above board kind of way, only to find out that it was mislabeled online. So embarrassing me, not even able to do the fake internet right. But you know, like I said, it's now The Case for Christ is now out on DVD, so it's free for everyone. Not free, but like, it is out there for people to see now. Since it did
we're not advocating piracy.
Yeah, we're not advocating piracy. You know, do what I say, not what I do. So it's out there. You know, it's kind of gotten a little bit of a push again. It's a good time to maybe bring it back up, since hopefully maybe people are seeing it again, because its run in the theater was incredibly short. I actually had planned to go see it in the theater, but it just did not stay long, which is really weird, because you know, PureFlix Films, that their whole gist is like, or their whole deal is, hey, we spent like $1 million to make a movie, and it's going to stay in the theater for like a month. And, you know, it's only going to make like $30 million, but, you know, if someone told me that I could invest $1 million and make 30 back, that's good math, you know? So that's like loaves and fishes kind of multiplication. So I appreciate
that. I'm not good with numbers, but that sounds about right. Yeah.
I don't appreciate people not laughing at my loaves and fishes joke. That was good. That's good Christian jokes right there. So anyway, the surprise to me is that there was a lot of positive buzz out there about The Case for Christ, which is not something that basically any movie from PureFlix really ever gets. You know, it's like critically panned, makes its money anyway, because you always have your aunt sending you a Facebook message telling you how this is going to change your life. Because we've all, you know, got like that aunt or that grandma or whatever it is.
Click share if you agree.
That's right. If you don't want to deny Jesus, make sure you share this. Make sure you get your ticket for Case for Christ, finally taking back the world for taking back Hollywood for Jesus, just like he would have wanted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing this movie, and it's out of the norm. Like, we actually intentionally don't review PureFlix films because I don't want to bash a film for that long. We reviewed The Shack earlier this year, which is kind of one of those, we don't typically review faith-based films, but even more so, we typically don't review PureFlix films, again, because it usually just makes us mad. But for some reason, there was a groundswell that said this was different, and I'm curious, with so much maligning of PureFlix in general and the films that they produce, kind of what made you want to see The Case for Christ at all? And I really don't care, Logan, Scott, you know, whichever you guys want to go for, jump in first. But like I said, I'm just kind of curious, because both of you guys really had some positive things to say. And I was, like I said, I was surprised. So what was it?
Well, I can start. This was a little bit different for me in that I followed the film pretty soon after I heard that it was coming out. And one of the things that kept being emphasized, particularly, interestingly enough, the real Lee Strobel's Twitter page, the thing that he kept pushing is, this is a real movie with a real director and real actors. And I don't know if there was intentional irony in that, but that's the thing that kept getting emphasized. And that's contrasted with when I think it was Facing the Giants first came out. The thing that was kind of being pushed as the cool thing about that film is it's like the cast is just this church that got together and made this movie.
Yeah.
And just that contrast struck me as really interesting. And so I was like, and, you know, I had been saying for a while, you know, if Christians want to make a real impact in the culture through Christian film, it needs to first and foremost be a good film. And that was the first thing that really showed that there was some promise that maybe that they were actually listening, going to make, you know, a legit movie. And that was what had me interested. And the trailer came out and I thought it looked pretty good. And so I think it's fair to say I had some fairly high expectations, comparatively speaking, going in. I actually had completely forgotten this was a PureFlix film until I was rewatching it and that title came up. And so that I think speaks volumes. The fact that I completely forgot that it was PureFlix was a studio that did this film, I think speaks volumes about it as well.
Well, so I feel like we all have a lot of assumptions about what that means. And I'd love, Logan, I'd love for you to kind of flesh it out just a little bit so that we're all using the same, or we're all kind of having the same assumptions, or we're looking at this from the same perspective. You were surprised that PureFlix was on, or, you know, kind of had its name attached to this film because what specific thing?
Well, let's just come out and say it. God's not dead. I want to be careful when I say here that I don't want to malign people's intentions whenever they're making, because I think people that make the types of films like God's Not Dead and even God's Not Dead 2 are doing that with their heart in the right place, I guess. We hope.
I was going to say, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt on that. Yeah.
But, you know, those films and those in particular have a tendency to have very simplistic portrayals of Christianity. The atheist is always the villain. The Christian is always absolutely perfect. And everything just turns out 100% great for the Christian in the end, usually with very little conflict in between. There's no struggling with difficult questions. There's no complexity there. The bad guys have the other view, and we're the good guys and we have the right views. And also there's usually a lack of production quality as well. And so you've got both of those things that kind of contribute to the stereotype of Christians in the secular culture as being closed-minded and, you know, anti-reason and, you know, all that sort of thing. That's not to say that, you know, the people who enjoy those movies are that. But I do think it's particularly to a secular culture that is what films like that tend to propagate or worsen.
Mm. Well, so it's interesting to me that one of the things that hooked you was Lee Strobel actually tweeting out that this movie, again, which was also surprising to me when I saw it, kind of being like, oh, this does seem different. You know, he was tweeting that it had a real director and real actors and stuff, because that's one of the things that I was looking at too. Like, how did this differentiate itself? What was it about this one that made me think that it was different than the God's Not Dead, you know? And so I went and looked up, like, who was the director? What, like, is that the answer? Is that what did it for me that made me like go, huh, that wasn't that bad. And I looked up the director. It's John Gunn. And I realized that he also directed Do You Believe? So Do You Believe is not something that people enjoyed or spoke highly of. And it had Mira Sorvino and Sean Austin. I mean, and it's not like they're like A-list actors. But, I mean, if you're comparing real actors to like Mike Vogel and Erica Christensen, like, okay, I think we're on the same level here. So I don't think you can use that, like, we've finagled people. Because the writer, Brian Bird, he, besides having some extensive credits on such Emmy Award winning shows as Touched by an Angel and Step by Step, he also wrote Captive, the movie that came out a year or two ago that had, it's not Rooney. It's the other Mara, Kate Mara. And, was it David or Oloyolo? Guy.
Oyelowo.
Yes. The guy that has the incredibly difficult last name to pronounce. I think it had them in it. So you're talking about another movie. I don't know if that was a PureFlix film. I'd have to look that up.
I don't think it was.
But the idea that, like, hey, you know, this is the guy who wrote that film as well. And that film for having... Those are actually A-list actors, I would say. Or pretty dang close. And that movie wasn't apparently all that great. So just who's involved in it, or just by upping the production value in and of itself, didn't seem to be all there was to what made this film more watchable or better. I don't think it hurt anything, but I'm curious, again, what else was it that was there? And Scott, I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about this too. I didn't mean to sidetrack us too much.
That's fine. Yeah. I was interested in this film, I guess, to go along with what we're trying to get at here. I listen to a lot of Christian Apologetic podcasts, and one of them had an interview with Lee Strobel. I think it might have been maybe it was Julie Roy is Up for Debate or something, but she was just interviewing Lee Strobel. And Lee Strobel said that Brian Bird they invited Bird to come to their house for an extensive stay. He was there for about 3 days, and they just hammered out all these details of Lee's life. They hammered out, you know, stuff that was in his book, The Case for Christ. And if you read The Case for Christ, he gives, I guess, some snippets of his personal life in there. But really, it was just a collection of the evidence that he had gathered from this whole journey that is portrayed in the film. But what I think was the winning formula with this was something that I have criticized PureFlix movies, Kendrick Brothers, I mean, you name it. They all have the same fault, it seems. And it's that their characters just are not developed. You cannot, they're not even close to three-dimensional. They might not even be two-dimensional. You can't relate to any of them. And with this one, I think it really shows Bird and Strobel's collaboration on this, because here's a PureFlix movie where their main character is an atheist. Okay. And we're not talking about like Professor Radisson or whatever his name was from A God's Not Dead. You know, we're not talking about that caliber. Like this guy, you know, Lee Strobel, portrayed in the film by what was his name again? Mike Vogel.
Mike Vogel.
He was good in Cloverfield too, by the way, for the short time he was in it. Spoilers. But anyways, he was just very relatable. He wasn't mad. He was like, you saw the love that, you know, he expressed for his wife and his kid, and his reason for being scared of his wife going to Christianity was because he thought that it would split the relationship up and he wanted the family to stay together. Yeah, I was just kind of shocked watching this. It's like, oh wow, I'm actually understanding the atheist perspective here. Even though I don't mesh with his worldview, I can understand where he's coming from. And I think Brian Bird, he really nailed this script right. Like he characterized Lee Strobel's life really well. I haven't all the interviews I've heard of Lee himself, you know, you think, oh, he's not going to say anything bad about his film. That's valid. But he seemed genuinely enthusiastic about promoting this film. And I don't have a lot of examples about that from other like biopics or whatnot, because, you know, creative license, you can take a story too far sometimes. And I'm sure they embellish details in Case for Christ as well. But it was just a winning formula. It was really intimate. And I was, like I said, I was really taken aback after watching this.
I hate to be the cynical. No, I don't hate to be a cynical one. I am just by default the cynical one. And I feel like I see far too many people who have like a vested interest in movies that have been adapted from their work or their writing that like are like, oh, it's so good. You know, maybe it's too many interviews like on late night or anything like that. Or the fact that like I never got to see it because the reviews are so bad, but like Stephen King talking about how like The Dark Tower was a good adaptation and, you know, he signed off on it, yet it was terrible, apparently.
I'm not going to comment on that. I still haven't seen it yet. I want to.
Yeah, so I haven't. But yeah. Like, that's the most recent example of someone being like, oh, yeah, I definitely give it my stamp of approval when, I mean, a lot of people, not that a lot of people haven't been wrong before, but a lot of people would have to be wrong for him to have not, you know, putting his stamp on that to get more people to go see it, because, you know, the more money he makes, he's probably like a producer, he's making more money. So again, cynical me, naysayer a little bit. So Lee Strobel endorsing a Lee Strobel biopic does not necessarily make me super excited. But
that's understandable. That's understandable to an extent. Yeah.
So I would say for me, it's not just the fact that Lee Strobel was promoting the film, but more what the emphasis was. So the emphasis that, you know, it's a real director and real actors versus just this message is being promoted and this message is good. That's more the thing that got me interested.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that's part of the differentiation that I wanted to kind of go back on myself a little bit, because I started talking about how, again, his self-promotion or even promoting the fact that there were real actors or real directors didn't necessarily make the movie good. But to be fair, my question was, what piqued your interest? And I would say, hey, anytime a movie takes the time to cast, maybe not, again, A-list actors, but it looks like they're trying, it definitely makes me more interested than not. But ultimately, what brought me to the film is having people who were interested for some reason come on social media or, you know, podcasts or whatever, in their reviews, saying, hey guys, like, I like to bash a PureFlix film as much as the next guy or girl, but maybe we should watch this because it's not half bad. And then there's the follow-up questions. Well, when you say it's not half bad, like, does that still mean it's worth my time, or like it's good for a PureFlix film, which, you know, the bar is still low. Mm-hmm. But then people like honestly kind of not necessarily defending it, but kind of like going to bat for it, just kind of endorsing it. People that, you know, like anything else, like one of the best things that a movie can have is not necessarily great marketing. I mean, because it would have to be really like out of this world, unique marketing to really be considered great marketing. But I don't need a great trailer. But if enough of my friends who see it say, you need to see this, that's going to trump Rotten Tomatoes for me. It's going to trump Metacritic. It's going to trump a bad trailer. So.
And this movie, I mean, at least in my opinion, did have a very bad trailer. Yeah. I was not a fan of the trailer for this film. I saw it and I was like, no, really? Not this one too.
Not like but, this.
Yeah. Not like this. Yeah.
So I was actually oddly excited to see it. I was about to pay money until, like, again, it didn't last in the theater very long, to see a PureFlix film, and that kind of blew my mind a little bit. But so something I want to kind of talk about is kind of the irony. I looked it up, and year to date, which is probably all it's going to make. I can't imagine it making some kind of weird theater run. Year to date, The Case for Christ has made $14.7 million, which, you know, if someone gave me $14.7 million, I would be very happy. But in the world of even PureFlix films, that's not great. It didn't stay in the theater very long. And I even looked it up and was very surprised by some films that made more money than The Case for Christ, such as amazing blockbusters like Resident Evil, The Final Chapter, which I don't even remember coming to a theater anywhere near me, or Monster Trucks, or The Great Wall, or Chips. You know, like these movies that have been like just critically panned and just beat down. So these films are the kind of films that are making more money than The Case for Christ, a film that we're saying for various reasons that we haven't 100% hit on yet, was worth our time. And what's really telling to me is that, I was kind of curious, especially since we did an episode on it earlier in the year, I was wondering how well The Shack did in comparison, and The Shack, made almost four times as much money, which is blockbuster money for, you know, a faith-based film.
I don't know how much the budget was for The Shack, but I know for Case of Christ, it was only like $3 million something. And they made like $1 million more than that on its opening weekend. So they made back everything that they put into it on its opening weekend. So I guess that's something to give it, you know. Well, it wasn't out in theaters long, I know that, but for what they put into it, you know, as at least they made it back, you know, and it was genuine. It was a genuine production. So,
well, okay. Yeah. And so, well, and again, that's their formula. So good for them for making cheap movies, that it is not difficult, to make your money back from. But I think the thing that surprised me, and I want to make sure I get these numbers right too. Like, so a movie that we all, it seems like, unless Logan's hiding something, some secret love for this film, God's Not Dead. God's Not Dead is kind of what we point to as like about everything that you can do wrong in a faith-based film, especially when people point to it and say that's a Christian film. So God's Not Dead, made domestically $61 million. So it also made about four times.
Don't make me cry. Don't make me cry.
This is my point. So The Case for Christ, which, you know, Scott, I'm talking to you before the show and you're telling me how you enjoy The Case for Christ enough that you would actually want to add it to your library.
Yeah, you know? Probably.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, it's making a quarter of the money that God's Not Dead is making. So, and also it's not staying in the theater very long. So how is it? Can someone explain to me? Can we theorize? Like, this really is, I'm open to hypothesis right now. Like, Logan, do you have any idea why we finally get a film that, like, we're actually starting to enjoy and it's not connecting with faith-based audiences? Like, what's the difference?
Well, I do think part of it is it's a limited theater run. I remember thinking that was really strange how that it only stayed in, because, I don't know how much of this was dependent on location.
How many people were seeing it, though? Like, if it was making money, theaters would keep it there because the theaters are making money, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know, because, I mean, at least in my circles, for the people I know who tend to really enjoy faith-based films, mm-hmm. None of them had any problems with it. All of them that saw it really liked it. So this is something that really perplexed me. And this is something that might just be anecdotal. It did not seem to me like this film was being given as big of a marketing push from PureFlix as a whole as their previous films had been.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that, I haven't really read into that, so I don't know how much of that is just what I happen to be seeing versus what was the case more generally. But it, mm-hmm. it did seem to me like this one had less of a marketing push, which I think might have been part of it because, I mean, if my memory serves me correctly, there was not exactly a whole lot of great competition at the time that this came out anyway. So yeah, I don't know. Cause, and it's not like Lee Strobel doesn't have the name recognition, for his book. I mean, it's a massively successful book. So, so my guess is maybe just not great marketing. That's about all I really have. Cause I have not heard anything negative about this film at all from the actual faith-based film audience.
Yeah. I would say that I definitely, it hasn't been, critiqueless, or critic proof, but it definitely, like I said, way more favorable. Scott, do you have something like a theory you want to float?
Yeah, and I think I'm going to steal your Cinecat for a bit. I've thought about this, and I'm going to try and be. I want our listeners to give me the benefit of the doubt here. I really think a big part of it has to deal with the fact that these characters were developed and the ones in God's Not Dead and its sequel are so underdeveloped that it's easy to just put yourself in to these Christian characters' places. And it's so easy to look at the other side and be like, ooh, you're wrong. You're the bad guys. And it's almost like those movies serve as like avatars that you can just place yourselves in.
It certainly sounds like you're describing it as when you're scrolling through your social media feed, like God's Not Dead is basically like the terrible unfactual meme that your far right or far left friend puts out there that like if even remotely fact checked wouldn't hold up, but it's so inflammatory, it's easy for them to get behind it and be like, ha ha, and confirmation bias and all those good things.
And to that point, one thing that really frustrated me about, Logan was talking about the marketing push, and I will agree with him that it's like, something was up with the marketing there. And I think if you want to call it the Christian community at large, largely failed in this aspect. I remember there's a apologetics group called Ratio Christi that is very popular. They're on college campuses, and they act as an outreach to students there, and they're very apologetic based. So you're not necessarily going to this group for like, I don't know, in intensive prayer or praise time. You're going there. It's like to study. It's like to hash out ideas and stuff like that. And I was a part of one of the groups for a bit, and I really enjoyed it. I believed in its vision until they started backing God's Not Dead 2, like I wouldn't believe. And it's like I understand it. God's Not Dead 2 had a few very popular apologetics writers and thinkers, and ones that I really respect and that I will go to them even if they were in that movie, right? Mm-hmm. But I didn't see those same people, and I didn't see Ratio Christi, for example, getting behind the case for Christ. And I was just flabbergasted by it. I was like, here is something that you will really want to show people to get out there in the open. It's not as inflammatory as works like the God's Not Dead franchise. It's unfortunate we have to call that a franchise. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know. Like, again, that's, I got the Cinecat on, but all signs I've seen just are pointing to that, and I hate that, but it's, I don't know. I don't know really how else to think about it. It's just, it's so easy to look at a side to a worldview and just be like, psh, they don't know anything, you know, whatever. They're just being mean to us, so we're going to fight back and everything. I mean, it's just this bipolar political atmosphere that we live in, and it just – it bled over, and yeah, I think that was a big part of it too.
Well, if you really want to be a little bit depressed or a lot depressed, depending on how it'll affect you, God's Not Dead, again, in the 60 million range, like War Room, 68 million. So,
yeah, yeah,
you know, that's what people are going to see. That's what people want to see. I mean, so this is something that we can kind of take a step back and look at on the macro level. When we talk about movies on this podcast, we're assuming that people are seeing them and that they're popular because people are voting with their dollars, right? So if they're voting with their dollars, there's something about it that they like or they're connecting, whether that's good or bad. And in this case, it's really frustrating to me. And one of the very first things before I even saw the movie that fascinated me was this thing that people were voting with their dollars. PureFlix makes a movie that critics actually are okay with. And they're kind of like, you know, it's not perfect, but, you know, dot, dot, dot. And Christians, the basically the target audience, despite what PureFlix thinks their audience may be, is making $0. And again, films like War Room, films like God's Not Dead, these are the films that are they're really raking it in. They're people are voting with their dollars. Like, this is what they want to see. They want to see things that are hyper stylized. They want to see characters that are more caricatures, that make them feel good, that back up their beliefs with pithy sayings that give them an easy solution to their faith, and that paint people who are faithless as easily defeatable or dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And that's being, I'd say that's maybe me being possibly a little harsh, but ultimately I think that's probably the general consensus. Again, not the general consensus is always right, but that's what we see. So I kind of want to switch gears a little bit and talk about The Case for Christ specifically. Like, what is in The Case for Christ that you like? What is it? Like I said, is it the acting? I think, Scott, you mentioned the screenplay you thought was really well. But like Logan, once you got in the door, once you were there, once you're watching the film, when it's over, like, what did you take away from it? Why did you say that, hey, that was pretty good?
One of the big things that jumps out to me, and I've seen it twice, and it jumped out to me with both viewings, is that these characters are not all lined up with a neat little list of, okay, here are all the good guys, and then here are all the bad guys. Because one of the examples that jumps out to me is Ray, who's Lee's mentor. So he's an atheist, very firmly an atheist. You learn at one point that he has in the past talked his daughter out of faith. But he actually gives Lee some really good advice. And, you know, you come to the conclusion at one point, you know, as the Christian audience disagree with him. But he's not a bad guy. Like, you know, he's not a bad person in the way that, you know.
He's not morally reprehensible.
Right, exactly. He's, you know, he's not Hercules from God's Not Dead.
Yeah.
And you've got the same thing on the other side too with Leslie. She, even after she becomes a Christian, first she hides it from him for a little bit. And then whenever she does talk to him, she's not, you know, doesn't have this sudden overwhelming burst from the Holy Spirit of eloquence. Like, she legit messes a few things up that she says, and like, and you can totally see, well, yeah, if I was in Lee's position, that probably would be kind of offensive. And and so, you know, Lee is in the wrong more than Leslie is, but there is that complexity to all the characters. And even when Lee is, you know, when he's drinking too much and when he's you know, having all these issues, you still see how he does actually care about his wife and his kids. He's not you know, this horrible, awful, no good person with no sense of morality before he becomes a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that reflects a lot more what we actually see in real life. I don't think it's a stretch to say that we all know atheists or agnostics who are, you know, what we might call moral people. They don't all fit the caricature that we tend to see in some of these other films. And that, and because it corresponds more to reality, I took away from that something that was a lot more meaningful just in seeing the personal journey that was there and the complexity that's there and that more reflects real life characters.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely a strength of the film. But I feel like I've talked a lot too. So I'm kind of, Scott, I want to hear your thoughts on basically the exact same thing.
If you can help me, what was the original question?
Well, I guess. So like I said, you've mentioned something like the script was incredibly strong for you. Like, mm-hmm. So like the movie specifically, what's it doing that kind of gives it you're okay? You know, not just that we're talking about it like, oh, it's good for a PureFlix film. Like, it's good enough for you to want to own. Like, what is it doing? Like, how is it connecting with you? What is it making you thinking about?
Well, I mean, I guess just to piggyback off of what Logan was saying, PureFlix finally learned that how to love their neighbor as themselves. It was that humanity that they brought to Lee's character, that they brought to Leslie's character, and that conflict that we see them in. You know, it was his mentor Ray mentioned earlier. There was one scene that was deleted, but I remember Lee Strobel was talking about it in an interview. There was a scene with his dad in a car or something, and the way he described it, it's like I can't wait to see that on the deleted scenes, because it was just a friction that he and his dad had. So it was like a father-son conflict in with there too. And you saw a little bit of that in the movie, but it really wasn't there too much. And I guess also I was able to be a skeptic along with Lee when he was going around and asking these questions to these various specialists in their fields of study. And that was really intriguing to me too, because one of the reasons why I was very interested in seeing this film was I was like, how are they going to incorporate the apologetics stuff into this without it being heavy-handed or out of place? And they just meshed it into Lee's journey, and each apologetics portion served as a missing piece to Lee's puzzle. And it was just really, I thought how they did the mystery aspect of this was really solid. I was just really surprised the whole thing. Also one bit, I guess just a comment about the production of this, it really felt like you were watching this in the time period that it was set in, the costumes, the music, what was playing on the, there was this one scene where he was watching TV and there's a Tootsie Roll, or Tootsie Pop commercial on. And it was that whole, owl with the, how many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? I was like, that is perfect. Like, not only was that commercial going on at that point in time, and it was really popular, but how it meshes with the story. Like, I don't know. I just thought that was really clever. Maybe it's too heavy-handed. I don't know. I enjoyed it. I wasn't expecting it.
The scene with the hairspray was great, too.
Yes. So, I don't know. I felt like I was in the time period that it was going on as well. So, kudos to them for that.
Well, I will say this. I believe that the fact that they painted Lee Strobel again as like a real character, like a flawed character who was not just a caricature of an atheist. They actually painted Lee Strobel as someone like that, like people I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who like his apologetics were not apologetics, or like not apologetics, but his rationale against faith were not things that I'd never heard before. But they were things that I feel like if you just kind of generally made up your mind, you're like, I'm just not interested in the whole God thing. I'm not interested in the whole Christianity specifically thing. Then I feel like most of his objections were, hey, I've never really given this a ton of thought, but on the surface, here's some actual realistic problems that I think you need to address. And they weren't just like cliche, like, oh, you just have to be weak, or you just need a crutch. Now he does kind of say some of those things, but in his actual evidence seeking, his fact finding mission, he's not really pouring those out as specific arguments to like doctors or you know, archaeologists or anything like that. And so that was refreshing, like I said, because he felt real. Because he just wasn't using like softballs that were just being thrown up, like the worst arguments that atheists could have, which is what I typically feel like I see, the opposite being done. Like when I go and read atheist blogs or I listen to atheist podcasts, I'm almost never hearing them talk about like the good that Christians are doing. They always basically are like, well, Joel Osteen did this thing, and I'm like, ugh, like, no, like we think that's ridiculous. Like, the majority of thoughtful Christians think that is ridiculous as well. Like, we're all on the same page. Like, you're holding that up as the argument. Like, no wonder you are an atheist. And vice versa, like God's not dead does the opposite. You know, no wonder if you think all atheists are like this, do you think they're evil and stupid? So we actually see an atheist that we can, again, kind of get behind. And I would say that it's a little problematic to me, even though we know how the movie's going to end, because for the most part, most everyone knows who Lee Strobel is. Mm-hmm. I almost don't like the fact that like he has a faith conversion in the film, because I feel like that's almost the most unrealistic thing.
even though it happened.
Yeah. Though it happened. But at the same time, it's like knowing that it's a true story. It's a, you know, a fictionalized true story, is one of the things that actually makes that like, okay. Like I'm like, well, he did, you know? So, I cannot agree with you, however, Scott, but on the pieces of actual like exposition that we get where he is going on his fact finding stuff. I will give the filmmakers credit, both the director for trying to frame it in a particular way and the screenwriter for trying to make it more interesting. But almost every time he goes to one of these places, I'm like, you flew to California to have like a 2-minute awkward conversation with this guy in a lab.
When you could have done it over the phone or something.
Yeah, he's like, this is why you had to come here. I'm like, again, for like a 2-minute conversation that asks like a basic question that he's probably heard hundreds of times before. But what we're doing is I can tell it's them trying to give us this evidence. But, how do I want to ask this? I'm going to ask myself that question. If someone comes up to you and says, you know, if I watch The Case for Christ, will I get arrows in my quiver to, you know, to do some real apologetics? Like, are you seeing that, Logan? Like, are you taking anything away from The Case of Christ that is actually like solid kind of evidence, or is it just kind of something that the film uses narratively to kind of show his transformation?
I think the stuff that they go over in the film is a decent introduction to the kind of stuff that's out there. But you should not settle just for that. This was actually one of the concerns I had with God's Not Dead 2, was that there are some snippets of good information in that. But if people go out just with that information saying, okay, now I'm educated in apologetics, you're going to get yourself in trouble real fast. So there is some really good stuff in there, but it's not the complete picture, because how could it be? It's this small part of this film, and it's not even the biggest part of the film. I mean, I would say the biggest part of the film is Lee and Leslie's marriage, which is really what gives the film its heart and the thing that I'm by far most invested in. So there is some good stuff. I mean, it has some of my favorite apologists in there. I love Gary Habermas's work. I love Bill Craig's work. But so what I would suggest is take what the work that these guys have done that you're introduced to here, go read their books, go get a more full understanding, and then go from there. I do not think that this film should be viewed as apologetics training material, but if that's someone's introduction and they're intrigued to go and seek out more, then I think that's a great thing.
Well, so I'm kind of curious, because I think we would probably all agree that the most intriguing part was not the fact finding. It was this relationship between Lee and Leslie. But since that's the case, and that seems to almost be the impetus for his search in the first place, and ultimately it looks like that may have more bearing than the evidence itself. Does the film actually undercut its own message and basically become something that atheists can point to and say, see, he's just doing what we're too smart to do, which is let his feelings and his experience get in the way of good fact, of good, you know, anti-apologetics or science or whatever you want to call it. Like, is the film defeating its own purpose?
That's a good question. I think that whatever paradigm you're working from, I think that by just casting off emotions entirely is not a particularly great way to go. Your vision of the facts should not be impaired by your emotions as much as you can help it. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that this was going to be an emotional life circumstance for him anyway. So I think you handle this in one of two ways. You either do a documentary, and so emotions aren't involved, or you do a film, which actually shows everything that Lee was going through. I think that this objection, though, might be part of why in the first conversation he has in the film with Gary Habermas, that actually comes up in their conversation, because Habermas says that, you know, that his wife had passed away and part of his hope is getting to see her again. And Lee says, well, isn't that then just make that hopeful thinking or wishful thinking on your part? And Habermas says, basically, well, the facts are still the facts, and if I get benefits from them, then I'm still going to be happy about those benefits. So I think that in and of itself can be a good answer to that. And so I think that the facts that are represented here are still good. I think you do not have to be a robot when researching these things in order to come to legitimate conclusions.
So when it comes to, or when we talk about faith, again, I think the opposite end of that spectrum, though it doesn't necessarily need to be, is the argument for evidence or facts. And that's what we typically get. That's the false kind of equivalent, or the false fight that we see. It's like either you believe the facts or you're taking something on faith. And I'm kind of curious, as much as you're willing to share, Scott, like what role does like evidence, like the kind of stuff that Lee is looking for in The Case for Christ, what role does evidence play in your faith? Your belief in Christianity?
Sure. I think in order to answer that, we need to define what faith is. And for me, I know this sounds rather relativist, but faith is not a blind leap. If I have faith in something, like if I have faith, my wife will do something. If I have faith that my car will get me to work, That's because I know my wife. I know my car. I trust them to do what they're going to do. So if faith is trust, then the evidence for that faith will strengthen that trust. And in the case of Christianity, will allow me to firmly set my trust in our Savior, Jesus Christ. So I think, you know, in conversations when this comes up, especially if you're with someone with a worldview different from yours, you know, just speaking from a Christian perspective, you really got to define what faith is and be on the same page with that before you get into, why do we need apologetics or, you know, why is this evidence meaningful in your life, or in the lives of, you know, millions, billions other people. So, yeah, I think that's where you need to start with that conversation. But that's how apologetics has benefited my faith. It wasn't too long ago. I guess just first year of marriage for me where, you know, my faith was something. There was something there. I called myself a Christian, but I didn't really understand what Christianity was. And then one camping trip, one faithful camping trip, I read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, which I'm sure millions of other people have done. But it really opened my eyes. I was like, oh, for the first time, like I understood that there were reasons for believing why Christianity was true, why this made sense, why this is life-changing. You know, I had read books of the Bible. I'm not going to be one of those people who say, well, I read the Bible cover to cover. You know, who does that? I don't think you're supposed to read it cover for cover personally, but it's just, you know, you read the scriptures and you get truth from that. That's what it is. It's pure truth. But in order, I guess for me, going to someone else and having them explain it in a way that I can like really understand on my level, on you know, modern terms, that was really beneficial for me. That was, I guess, just from a personal perspective, after reading Mere Christianity, that really changed my life around. And I continued to seek out other apologetics materials. I found Bill Craig. I found Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason. I found lots of folks. I was like, wow, it's not just Lee Strobel now, or it's not just C.S. Lewis. It is these other people like Lee Strobel. And you know, they all came to the same conclusions as well. So, yeah, that's I kind of rambled there. But, yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming at with this.
No, I mean, it answers the question, or at least, you know, it answers the question. And I think as fully away as that you're able to, which is all any of us can really do. And any of us, just like Logan, being asked the same question. Logan, how does evidence play into your faith?
I would give much the same answer that Scott did. Something I find interesting is when you look in a lot of the Old Testament prophecies of future coming blessing, a lot of those will invoke the past things that God has done. So just like God made and fulfilled this promise to Abraham, God is going to fulfill the promise to the new Israel. I think that it helps things a lot when we look at it in that way, that we see evidence for God, evidence of what God has done in the past, so he'll do that in the future. I think we can apply that same principle to God's existence as well. It doesn't mean we will have every single question answered, but it does mean that God has left evidence for us to conclude that he does exist, that the attributes of a world with a creator are clearly seen. And so with that, you know, and so I think that, you know, that idea and that principle leaves room for we should seek out the evidence because God's world is going to be consistent with what he has revealed about himself. But it also doesn't promise that we're going to have all the questions answered. And so there's still going to need to be some room for faith and trusting God when it comes to some of those questions.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest parts to reconcile. I mean, you both are hitting on trust, and I feel like these are the conversations I have over and over. Usually, the word faith, like I'm glad you wanted to define it, Scott, because I think the word faith gets thrown out by my non-believing, whether they're agnostic or atheist, friends and acquaintances. The idea that ultimately they're like, well, ultimately it comes down to faith and you have faith and I'm not silly, so I win. And the faith isn't just like an illogical leap into, fairyland. It's something that you trust is going to happen or that you trust in because everything points to it. I'm trying to not really have to use this quote because we've already mentioned C.S. Lewis like three times, but
just let it out.
It's like when I have conversations with relatives and they really hate the F word, in this particular case, faith, they think that like, I'm too smart to just believe in something. And I just am on the same page with C.S. Lewis when, you know, he says that I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And I am convinced that relatives that I have these conversations with think that even though I may do almost everything logical in my life, like I'm actually leaving logic behind to believe that there's a God. And yet I think it's the most logical thing that I can do to believe in God. Not because it's, I mean, well, I think ultimately, especially the way the Bible defines it, is foolish not to believe in God. But I think there's a lot of good reasons, and there's a lot of people arguing against the belief of God and belief in Christianity. So I don't necessarily think they're automatically stupid, but when we ultimately get down to the nitty gritty, and I think about the way that the Bible unfolds and the way that either man acts in the Old Testament or Christ describes humanity in the New Testament, or that we're just exposed to story after story in the Bible about how people act and why they act that way, and why they're going to continue to act a certain way, and why this is this way and why that was that way. Like it actually makes the world make sense. My non-believing friends have no explanation. It's most of theirs is hope or faith that humanity will do good or ultimately choose the right thing. And I can say, I don't have to have faith that humanity is going to do the right thing. One, because I have no evidence that they will choose to do the right thing, because history. but I can look at the Bible, and the Bible says, like, there is hope, but ultimately things are this way. And I go, things are this way. I always approach things like the case for Christ when people are actually trying to get that like scientific knowledge, because I tend to be more swayed by like philosophical arguments, the nature of humanity, things like that, than actual concrete, like, you know, there were 1400 copies of this New Testament written by this time, and it's the most, you know, there were this many people that saw Jesus and they wrote it down on this piece of paper, and we have that piece of paper, and, you know, all these like super scientific facts, like enough that gets me to believe that the Bible is real or the Bible is reliable. And then it's mostly just looking at humanity basically sociologically, psychologically, and realizing where we're at. So evidence plays a part, but honestly, I feel like if you look around and you ask yourself, why do things happen, and you can't explain it, I've got a pretty good theory. Mm-hmm. And you might call that faith, but I feel like it's evidence. So, when I look at a film like The Case for Christ, I think we've all kind of come to the conclusion, like, it's probably not a great start-stop for apologetics, but it might get you interested. I'm kind of curious, outside of that, why should people be watching this movie? What is it like? What are people going to take away? Is it just, I mean, it's just a good movie. Like it's a well worth your time. Is there any other like encouragement or, lesson that they could take away from it? Like Scott?
Well, I mean, I think even if it was, something that wasn't, like based in Christian apologetics or even based in Christianity, if it was, you know, the same story about a husband and a wife with developing opposing worldviews, and it was written as respectfully as this one was, I would still watch it and I would still enjoy it. I mean, it's just, it comes, if you strip away the hard Christianity facts, the apologetics that we talked about, if you strip away that at its core, it's this story about a husband and a wife who are on the verge of separation and, you know, their marriage being totally annihilated, but they are able to come to the same conclusions in their own different ways. You know, God talks to everyone in different ways. That doesn't mean the evidence or the apologetics, it doesn't mean the facts change. It's just, he knows how to present these to us, and we all respond differently to these various aspects of what a worldview presents. And I think just on that basis, this movie is well worth at least one viewing. It was just a very respectful and intimate story. And I mean, PureFlix comments aside, I thought it was genuine. Like I just really appreciated how genuine and respectful it was of its, and especially of its characters.
Well, and I think that's a great point. I am actually just curious. Like, I feel like when we go see these movies, like it has to be because it has some specific thing that it's going to like blow us away with. But I think it's almost unfair. Because we're looking at a PureFlix film and we're asking, is the message either offensive or so wrong that it's not worth our time? And so the flip side of that, I think automatically is like, is the message at least tolerable? Well, that makes it worth our time. And what we're, I think, arguing for, at least mostly, not totally, is that, hey, what if we just judge The Case for Christ like we judge most films when we recommend them to our friends? Just like, I was engaged, it was intriguing, it made me, it entertained me, it made me think a little bit. Good job. Let's just take the PureFlix thing out.
Right.
The PureFlix positive negative out of it. Logan, kind of like, any last things that you wanted to hit on with the film? Like, did it also, like I said, besides the evidence and the marriage, like, was there something there that really, kind of stuck with you or, you thought was noteworthy about the film?
I feel like I keep coming back to this, but I really like the relationship between Lee and Leslie in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think, so this is not the first time that a Christian film has had a couple arguing or in tense moments or in fights. But, man, these just felt a lot more real than a lot of those tend to. And the film lets them have those moments of tension and when things are just very definitely not okay. One of my criticisms of God's Not Dead 2 was, one of the things that bothered me most about the movie is that the one time in that movie when there's actually some tension, it lasts about 30 seconds. That might not even be an exaggeration. And then a choir shows up singing on her doorstep. But in this film, like, they actually let the tension sit there for a lot of the film. And like those scenes where they fight are intense. And then one of the more intense scenes where they're fighting, Lee apologizes to their kid before he leaves. He does not apologize to his wife. Mm-hmm. And they don't really make a big point about that, but that's just something that I kind of noticed. And that just makes the stakes of the film, I think, a lot more engaging. And so it does have a lot of good to it just in terms of the message, I think. It shows what the cost that married people can possibly be looking at whenever if they become a Christian and their spouse is not, or not even necessarily spouse, but just a conflict that can cause with other people in your life. And I think that does a good job of kind of contrasting with, you know, the flowery rosy image we sometimes have of you become a Christian, then all the problems in your life get solved. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I really keep coming back to that relationship between the two of them and just how much more authentic that was. Even with my higher expectations, it kind of exceeded those to some extent.
I think that's one of the hardest things to do too. It's the watching people portray what they think marriage is on screen is something that almost makes me roll my eyes and turns me against most, because most of the times people are talking about like married couples, it's usually like in a romantic comedy or just a comedy in general. So people are like buffoons and making dumb choices. And
yeah,
if you can actually write or script out a realistic married couple, like one, I think it's incredibly hard to do because it almost makes you have to focus on things that are not huge deals. It's small. It's small things like not apologizing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's one of the reasons that, despite the fact that like probably, a third of the show was almost like comically drama driven, like fake teenage drivel, Friday Night Lights is like one of my favorite shows. Because the Friday Night Lights was one of the most realistic pictures of marriage that I've ever seen on the big screen or the small screen. Hmm. And, you know, like I said, a third of it's cutting away to people having kind of over hyper stylized, super dramatic, like teenage, like love triangles and stuff. But at least a third of it is just the relationship between like Coach and Tammy Taylor. And that is quality TV, watching two people try to figure out marriage in stressful situations and the good and the bad. And that will make me watch just about anything because I think it's so rare to see. And while I don't,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and while I don't think The Case for Christ is for those people who have seen Friday Night Lights, I don't think this definitely reaches those levels. It is compelling enough, and there are those moments that I go, yep, I've had that conversation. I mean, not specifically about being a Christian or not, but like the tone and the like how you leave it and how you approach that conversation, the awkwardness of it, or how a particular type of conversation can almost ruin an evening that was otherwise perfect, because marriage is tough. So, what were you gonna say, Logan?
Oh, that was me.
Sorry.
I was just gonna say. So, what are your thoughts on Fireproof?
So I remember watching Fireproof with my wife, and we did it like in a very kind of like, all right. Yeah, because it's the beginning of like the faith-based film push, right? So we weren't
close to it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we weren't 1,000% against it as like a whole, but we were kind of like ready to eye roll,
mm-hmm.
Just at its existence. And because it was probably going to have a very straightforward, you know, everything comes together, the end kind of message. And it did. The thing about something like Fireproof is in its, I for me personally, because again, everybody's marriage looks different. The non-realisticness of their marriage to me, at the time, still reminded me of how important my marriage was to me. And so Fireproof kind of got me, but in like the way that it's like the opposite, like you see something really terrible and it affects you emotionally because you know that there's something way more beautiful out there. I don't know if I'm explaining that well enough. Like you see an ice cream cone that's full of dog poop and you start crying.
Wonderful image.
Yeah. And you start crying because you realize that when you go home, you're going to have an ice cream cone that's full of ice cream and that makes you happy. That was me watching Fireproof going, this is so bad. This is so terrible. But like the whole thing is making me think about my own relationship. And how much like, I'm glad that like, we don't communicate that poorly or like, not like both of us are, we're two human beings. So we're obviously very selfish, like me and my wife. Basically anybody, not just like specifically us, but we're all selfish, sinful people. So, thinking that even in our selfishness, like we know how to communicate better than they did in Fireproof and, we have better, more constructive ways of working through our problems. And we don't need some kind of gimmicky book to do something that's probably not going to last more than a couple months. But don't let them tell you that because then they don't get to sell you as many books and copies of Fireproof at your church Bible studies. So that is my full cynical view of that movie.
I'm a little bit more positive on Fireproof than I am of other films that are, I guess you would describe it as its peers, mm-hmm. Or other films in the genre. I will say that even given the weaknesses of the film, you know, just as a story, that first big fight in the film does tend to get me a little bit. You know, the screaming match when, you know, he's, you know, yelling at her and she, you know, finally says, I want a divorce and that whole thing. Just because there's a part of me that's always like, you know, I could be like him. You know, like mm-hmm. I'm thankfully like I have never done that, but there's always a part of me. It's like, you know, that could be me. And there's some other things about Caleb in the film that are kind of on a personal level, like I see more similarities with myself in. And I also saw the movie before I was married originally. And so I think it's also true that I was even more similar to Caleb then than I am now. I don't think it's a particularly good portrayal of a relationship in the same way that like The Case for Christ is. And you know, you don't have a real couple to base it off of and all that. But so I guess I'm saying all that to say I still would not hold up Fireproof as a good movie, but I think it has more saving grace if only for personal reasons on my part than some other similar films do.
The reason I brought Fireproof into this discussion was that my wife and I, after we watched Case for Christ, we had a really good little comparison discussion between the marriage dynamic in Case for Christ versus the marriage dynamic in Fireproof. And the reason I brought this to our discussion is because I think the – and this goes back to the writing of Case for Christ and the fallout from their – like the big argument. In both these movies, you have like the big argument. And you have – the fallout from each is different. In Fireproof, it just felt forced. It's like what you were saying, Mikey, about, oh, well, here's your book, you know, try to hit all these points and you're going to be good to go. But in Case for Christ, it just felt natural. The leading up to the argument felt natural. In the argument, it felt natural. They said what they meant. I think even Lee let out like a very mild curse word. I think he said like, damn it, or something like that. And in Fireproof, you know, at the climax of their argument, he's like, you ungrateful. And you think he's going to say, oh, gosh, here it comes, you know, the bad word. No, he's just, you ungrateful woman. And he just, like stumbles over the words like, oh, okay, this isn't real. This conversation, this did not happen in real life. This is not real. So
that's very fair. Yeah.
Yeah. So and then just the fallout from that big argument, what happens to each of the characters, how they come to reconciliation. It was so much more natural in the Case for Christ, I guess. I won't get into too much details because we've been going on a bit, but I just wanted to, I guess, give my rationale for entering Fireproof into this discussion.
Well, and, you know, there is a difference between, I said that Caleb is, you know, I look at that and I say, that could be me, you know, more or less if I'm not careful.
Sure, sure.
But I think the stuff with Lee hits a little bit closer to home because I have said stuff like that. It's not just like I could be that, but like it hits closer to home because it's like, no, I have been that. And you know, in certain ways. And I think it was Mikey said earlier that, you know, it's like, yeah, I've had that conversation. You have those moments. I think that in the end, those are a lot more meaningful, you know, especially with Lee being a more nuanced character, because then you start to identify with him in the beginning of the film because you're like, oh, he's this guy that cares about his family. You know, he works hard at his job. But then you see the ways in which he's really hurting his family. And then when you see similarities there, then it's like, oh boy, that really starts to hit, I think, closer to home in a more impactful way.
I think what would be really hard for Christians to watch, and something that I feel almost needs to be made just to kind of prove a point, when you talk about like we see Lee starting to hurt his family, like the story that we get in this movie still shows us that the atheist is a little more callous and willing to hurt his family. Whereas we do see Leslie like kind of make mistakes or not say things right. But like Leslie's never like scaring their child or coming home drunk. So like, I think if we're going to be fair, then I think we need to see people like doing awful things to their family while still proclaiming like to be a Christian. Not because I think that we need more of that in the world, but just because I think it's still a little bit unfair to say like this. I mean, again, it's a fictionalized true story. So we're assuming that in this particular case, this is what Lee actually did because he's signing off on it. But we're still seeing that, like, there's no fault. There's no real underhandedness or callousness from the people who are Christian. And that makes it almost unrealistic at times.
Yeah. I really like that idea, too, because one of the things I liked about doing this particular story is it actually addresses one of the charges that skeptics make. Like, you know, you can't actually be pro-science or pro-fact and be a Christian. Mm-hmm. But another one that I think also hits really close to home is how many people never are interested in Christianity because they had someone in their life that was this horrid hypocrite.
Yeah.
And now mm-hmm. they'll never go to it again. And so, like, I could definitely see doing, you know, sort of like a Fences sort of film where the father is, you know, a pastor or, you know, a church leader of some sort. Because, you know, I know several people, and I venture to guess that you guys, too, who were really betrayed by church leaders in some deep and hurtful ways. I mean, I think as Christians, we need to have an answer to that when it comes up, because people who have been hurt in those situations, I mean, those people are very real, and there are a lot more of them, I think, than sometimes we realize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless you guys have something else specific, I'm pretty satisfied with the diving into this movie that I think will be a surprise to some people that we even cover, mainly because, again, we tend to never do pure flix films on this on this podcast, for gooder or for worser, and because, again, this movie was surprisingly unpopular. You know, like we pointed out that I'm sure people have made plenty of money who produced it because of the nature of releasing the film wide and making a small amount of money on an incredibly small amount of budget. But, you know, it's barely in theaters, blip on the radar, a couple people said some good things, and people moved on. But I think there is some good there. So I'm glad we got to talk about it. And with that, I hope that everyone else has enjoyed this conversation. I hope that you enjoyed this movie to some degree. I hope that you've had a chance to see the movie because, you know, I am perfectly fine conceptually with the idea of faith-based films. I would prefer them to get better, and this proves that they can be better. Now, this still is a long, far cry from Oscar contention, but... maybe one day. But mm-hmm. I still think if anything is going to be Oscar worthy, that, Christians, again, much like the case for Christ, will probably not show up to support it. Cough, silence, cough. with that said, great conversations happen because we have great guests. So I want you, the listeners, to be able to, you know, kind of pick the brain of Logan and Scott and just continue this conversation in any way that you can. So, Scott, how can people follow your work or follow you around the interwebs?
Sure. Well, I write primarily for Real World Theology, so you can find my work there, including the review, the lengthy review I posted for Case for Christ. I think Gene gave me a little flack for that, but hey, I thought it turned out good. So there, Gene. But yeah, I'm also on Twitter. So you can find me there. I'm on Facebook. I interact with the Real World Theology groups. You can find my name there. And so, yeah, I'm just hanging around the good groups, I guess.
Just the good groups.
Yes, just the good groups. I don't have time for the bad or even the mediocre groups.
That's right.
Just the good groups.
Hey, so Logan, how can people follow the work that you do?
So I write and podcast at clearlens.org and along with Gene, actually, whether for better or for worse. So you can always hit me up there. I also write at the website Cross Culture. And the URL for that is christianentertainmentreviews.com. And the Twitter handle for that is @ChristCultural. And you can also find me on Twitter @LoganRJudy.
Awesome. And we will have all those ways to follow our guests at realworldtheology.com. You can follow me @Physification on Twitter. Again, the best way to interact with probably anyone you've ever heard on this show, especially me, is to come to the Facebook discussion group, the Real World Theology Facebook discussion group. It is different than our actual Facebook page, where we're mostly just letting people know of new articles and podcasts that we're putting out. The discussion group is where we link and chat and have a pretty awesome community. So if you can find that, awesome. You'll find it in the show notes, again, at realworldtheology.com. Go to realworldtheology.com/support and see all the ways that you can support us, depending on when this comes out. You may find that there are some brand new ways that you can support the show, and I would encourage you to explore that. So please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It always is awesome to get more 5-star reviews over at iTunes. It helps us out tremendously. Boosts our rankings, more people find us, more people join the conversation, and to this point, we have found that that's been a great thing. So, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
If I could be professionally unemployed, I'll have to ask Aaron about that.
Well, what I was actually going to say earlier is you could move to Seattle, then you could help Aaron find a job too.
Yeah. You could move to Seattle. You could live with Aaron because, I mean, there's got to be some kind of formula for, like, not being employed and yet still being able to pay rent. So figure out how that works. And then just start a sitcom. You could call it Two Broke Guys because apparently you don't have to actually be funny or be employed to have a sitcom. So... I mean, yeah. I honestly think like you both are so personable and you both like starting, we'll call them conversations online. So like people are obviously going to be interested in your daily activities, you know, like what movies did Aaron watch today?
Oh, naturally. You know? Yes.
And
oh, yeah.
Like how many people did Scott piss off today because he didn't like a movie? You know, like it's formulaic, but it's like I said, it's network television.
That actually sounds kind of perfect,
right? I mean, I would probably
watch
it.
That made my night, right there. That made my night.
With good enough writers, I would watch it. So,
I don't know. Aaron's a cat guy, though, so most of the sitcom will just be me in the hospital having allergic reactions.
Well, see, there's your conflict, you know, like like two guys thrown together out of necessity, but there's a cat that's screwing it up, but. The cat's not going anywhere because Aaron's in love with a cat, you know? It's his...
Oh, yeah.
And then the twist at the very end of the episode in the hospital room is that Aaron put the cat in Scott's room because he got mad about a movie that Scott didn't like.
Scott said something like, I think Christopher Nolan is overrated. And that's when the cat appeared in the room.
And that's when the swelling started.
That's right. It's fiendish. See, this has become like some kind of crime thriller.
I like this.
So many twists and turns, and I'm already hooked, and I haven't even seen the pilot.